On Sunday, April 8th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will feature the electric Miles Davis period, with producer, composer, and percussionist with Miles Davis, James M. Toomey. That's Sunday, April 8th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. I don't have time for the theme tonight because there's so much to talk about. As a matter of fact, I have to get in touch with this guest right here. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. And on the line I have Lakeisha Benjamin.
Hey, how are you?
All right. Good. Thank you for joining us. We just finished listening to Maceo.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, that is a personal favorite. And your CD release party was last week at La Poisson Rouge.
Yes, it was.
It looked like a big success to me, was it?
Yeah, it was a pretty good success.
Yeah. So tell me, Lakeisha. Actually, okay. Tell me how you came about making this CD. Because first off, let me say, because I shared this with you, but I didn't tell you I was going to mention this over the air. I saw you on Ken Burns Jazz from LaGuardia High School. They had some students from LaGuardia High School. How'd you wind up in Ken Burns Jazz?
I think LaGuardia High School, they at that time, they were like competing in the Essentially Ellington competition at Lincoln Center.
Mm-hmm.
So my school was like one of the finalists.
Oh, okay.
So I'm not exactly sure how my director hooked it up, but I think they were doing a special on that too.
Okay.
Just jazz and, you know, young people and Lincoln Center and something like that. That's the gist I got from it, but I was also like, you know, a 16-year-old perspective, so I'm not exactly sure.
I mean, you look like a deer in headlights. It's like things were going on around you.
Yeah.
But it was nice to see. It's like, oh my gosh, there's Lakeisha Benjamin. Now, okay, we will quickly get to your CD, but before we do that, you have played with Rashid Ali, the drummer, the late Rashid Ali.
Yes.
I've seen you with Jane Cortez, the poet. How did you wind up working with those folks?
With Rashid, I met him actually at this place, Cleopatra's Needle.
Okay.
I used to go there. Like, I actually didn't have any money to get there, so I used to walk from my house in Harlem all the way over there, and or sometimes from the village there.
Mm-hmm.
And I got there really late one night, and I played a little bit of jams, and they took a break, and then I went and sat at the bar. I didn't drink, but I just sat there, and I sat next to this guy. I didn't know who he was, and he was talking to me, and I was talking to him. And then after a while, he was like, okay, I'm going to go home. And I was like, okay, I'm about to go play. And he was like, oh, you play something? I was like, yeah, I play sax. And he was like, get out of here. I'm going to stay and watch you.
Wow.
I played some song. And then he was like, yeah, you're kind of good. You should come by the gym. And I was like, oh, I don't work out. And he was like, no, I usually rehearse at my house. I call at the gym. You'll see when you give me a call.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, okay. I gave him a call. And then, you know, my friend was also at the time, Lawrence Clark, a tenor player, was in his band. He told me who he was, and I was like, oh, really? So I gave him a call, and I went down there. We played.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from then on, it kind of went like that.
Oh, okay. So tell me about the CD. How did it come together? I understand you wrote everything except for one.
Yes.
How was that process like, writing all of it? Had you been working on it?
On this particular CD, I would say maybe like a year and a half, but I mean, in general, I write a lot. Like,
oh.
I'm pretty big on composing.
Uh-huh.
So I have like, you know, very wide range of like different compositions.
Uh-huh.
But I really got, I guess, in the shit for this CD. I had some songs that I have written before in the past that I wanted to, you know, bring to life on this.
Uh-huh.
And there were some awful things I wrote, you know, particularly with the CD in mind.
Well, this is a great CD. You have several people featured on here. One of them is a former Sugar in My Bowl guest, Brandy Younger.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Brandy.
Yeah, and you have many singers. Now, there's somebody on here. I'm playing Jump and Shout in the background. And
yeah.
You have China Black singing on that one.
Yeah, I do.
How did you wind up selecting the singers?
I guess with each one of them was a very particular process, but if I could summarize it, you know, it was each song I felt like had a different vibe and a different flavor to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really feel like it was fair to have the same voice on everything, you know, and
mm-hmm.
I really wanted everything to be authentic to the mood and the emotion I was creating.
Well, I think you definitely succeeded in that because every singer fits the song. Their voice fits the song. So the song that you didn't write is Don't You Worry About a Thing by Stevie Wonder. How did you select that?
I was going through a lot of songs. I didn't know if I wanted to kind of slow it down and play a sexy song or something. I was, you know, it's kind of hard when every song you wrote and you're looking for something just to kind of embody something else. But I came across it because I was looking through my iTunes, like, at a bunch of Stevie Wonder songs. I'm always, like, obsessed with learning his songs.
Oh, okay.
And then I saw Don't You Worry About a Thing, and I was I had been, like, you know, really, like, trying to get the band together, so many people to rehearse, other people organized.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about it. I was like, wow, don't you worry about a thing.
Wow, excellent.
It's kind of like a good, like, you know, summary of how I feel about the album at the end of the day.
Right. So do you have anything coming up next other than, well, now that you've released the CD? Do you have anything in the area?
No, nothing in the area recently. I mean, in July, we are playing like a little East Coast tour, and we're doing the Peekskill Festival. In August, okay. I'll be playing with Charlie Parker.
Oh, excellent. In August, yes.
Yeah, but then after that, I also have my CD's coming out in Europe in October.
Oh.
So I'm doing a lot of stuff focusing on that. Like, I'll be doing another European tour and stuff, so...
Well, thank you so much, Lakeisha Benjamin. And people can find you at lakeishabenjamin.com. That's LakeishaBenjamin.com. I got it, right?
Yes, you got it.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Lakeisha, for joining us. I'm sorry it was so quick, but I've got M2May coming up. Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
Have a good night.
Okay, bye.
Bye. And that was Lakeisha Benjamin, and her release is called Retox, R-E-T-O-X. And once again, you could find her at Lakeisha Benjamin, L-A-K-E-C-I-A, Benjamin, B-E-N-J-A-M-I-N.com. Stay tuned for James M. Toomey. Hi, my name's Joyce Jones, and I'm here with...
Hank Williams.
We're also here with our videographer, Kazembe Balogun. He's documenting everything that's happening here. Thank you so much, Kazembe Balogun, for coming in and tearing yourself away from Miles, the baby. Yes, he has baby name Miles. I'm going to quote a CD insert with regard to how to introduce our guests. Miles had known M. Toomey, a.k.a. James Foreman, a.k.a. James M. apostrophe Toomey, a.k.a. M. Toomey Heath, since the percussionist was a youngster. M. Toomey joined the band in 1971. So what's your name, sir?
James M. Toomey, a.k.a. James M. Toomey.
Do you want to explain all of that?
No, I mean, only to this extent. I mean, some of those are incorrect. It was always James Foreman. You know, Jimmy Heath is my biological father, and James Foreman raised me, who was also a musician. Back in 1966, when I went to L.A. to go to school, it was during the Cultural Revolution, and I changed my name to M. Toomey, and it's been like that ever since. At least the IRS agrees.
Well, that's actually the perfect lead into our next question, because one of the things we wanted to ask was how you came to be connected with the US organization and Kawaita Theory.
Oh, you did some homework. Okay. I like this.
A little bit.
Well, like I said, I went out to California on a swimming scholarship, which is, you know, a little different. I was a Middle Atlantic AAU
UCLA?
Champion. No, I went to Pasadena College, which was the reason I went there. That was a precursor for UCLA, but I was going to go there for 2 years because the next Olympic coach mm-hmm. was going to be the swimming coach there, a man named Don Gamble. And he saw me at the National AAU Championship. I had about 40-something scholarships, but I said, well, why don't you come here? He said, I'll be coaching, and I'm going to be the 68 Olympic coach. So that's what made that decision. While I was there, obviously it was the year after the Watts Revolt.
Right.
And that summer I worked as a lifeguard in Watts, and they were having the first Watts Festival, and all these poets and stuff. So I said, one day I just walked around down in Watts, and they were having all these black nationalists speak, and that's where I heard Marlana Karanga, Ron Karanga at that time, and Stokely, and everybody was there. And it was at that time I began to open up politically. I was already... somewhat open. You know, my father back in Philly, first time I ever heard Malcolm X, and my father took me to see him and took me and my younger brother Jamil. And I remember I was coming out of church and he was like, don't take your clothes off, you know, keep your suit on. And I'm into, oh, where are we going out to, you know, somewhere to have dinner, right. You know, my aunt. I'm ready to play basketball. We all got in the car and we drove. And I looked up and I said, on the marquee, it said, tonight, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, opening speaker, Malcolm X. I was 14 years old. And I remember how impressed I was with that. So having that experience when I went out to L.A., you know, and obviously later on I joined the US organization and was associated with that for the next couple of years until I came back to the East Coast. Kwanzaa, I think, well, actually the second Kwanzaa. The first Kwanzaa was very few people. The second Kwanzaa that I attended was 67, when it was about 40 of us in an apartment building. And everybody was saying, boy, they're crazy. What is this thing, Kwanzaa? They thought it was anti-Christmas and all that. And to now stand back and see the millions and millions of people, started with a small group of people, and to see what it's grown to is you know, overwhelming.
Nguzo Saba. The seven principles. Umoja. Unity. To strive for and maintain unity in the family, community, nation, and race.
Kujichagulia. Self-determination. To define ourselves, name ourselves, speak for ourselves, and create for ourselves. Not to be defined and spoken for by others.
Ujima, collective work and responsibility to build and maintain our community together and to make our brothers and sisters' problems our problems and to solve them together.
Ujima, cooperative economics. To build and maintain our own stores, shops, and other businesses, and to profit together from them.
Nia, purpose. To make as our collective vocation the building and developing of our community in order to restore our people to their traditional greatness. Nia, purpose.
Boomba, creativity, to do always as much as we can, in the way we can in order to leave our community more beautiful and beneficial than when we inherit.
Imani, faith, to believe with all our heart in our parents, our teachers, our leaders, our people, and the righteousness and victory of our struggle. A man without values is a man that is unpredictable. Go back to tradition is the first step forward. Consciousness is accepting the fact that you're black and working from that revelation.
We recognize ourselves as being the teachers of the universe.
We have to be considerate of each other And what you do when you are considerate is maximize the good and minimize the bad.
We don't borrow from Africa.
Teach.
We utilize that which was ours to start with.
The quotable Karanga, the quotable Karanga, the quotable Karanga. All praise is due to the black man. All praise is due to the black man.
Si fa yo te ina.
Si fa yo te ina. Tu e yo si. Si fa yo te ina. Babarigani. Fahere ya kunala. Babarigani. Mamu, mamu. Jumbo.
See Jumbo.
See Jumbo. Put a Jumbo.
See Jumbo. Coochie Jackalia.
Put a Jumbo.
Somebody got it.
Sante.
Blacks can't be discriminated until they have a cultural context to create our
quotable. Kawaida. We must name ourselves.
Speak for ourselves.
Break down.
Instead of being spoken for and defined by others.
Teach.
Ujamaa. Learn.
Soul session 530.
Kujichagulia.
All praise due. Master teacher.
Ujima.
Imani.
Nia. Uumba. Jama.
Culture is the basis of all ideas, images, and actions. To solve is to move culturally by a set of values given to you by your culture.
Imani.
We must carve a world out of the reality of our own beings. Art must be collective, functional, and committing.
Self-determination.
Purpose.
Creativity. Direction.
Faith.
Imani.
Unity.
Umoja.
Where is the black man's nation? Where is the black man's nation?
Hopefully, Kwenu.
Bile, bile.
Praises due.
On the subject of Kawaida and us organization, there was a recording that I've gotten mixed information. It apparently was originally released by your uncle, Albert Tootie Heath, and it was titled Kawaida. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I think it was on OB Records.
Right.
You know, my uncle, Tootie Kumba, is a Swahili name, was always a great inspiration to me. You know, when I was a kid, he was more of a big brother than an uncle. So whenever he'd come in town, I'd rush over and we'd sit. And so when he was getting ready to do this album, he just, one day he called me. He said, I want you to write all the music. And I'm like, what? He said, no, I want you to write me. He said, I have one song I want to record. And he said, the rest of it I want you to write. So I said, well, who's on session? He said, well, Tayati, your father, Herbie Hancock, Imwandishi. Because when you see the Swahili names, I gave all the, to Herbie Hancock when they came out. All those brothers adopted Swahili names when they had their band. But Don Cherry was on. So I'm like, you want me to write? And he gave me my first opportunity.
Now, I also have that someone named Billy Bonner was on flute and percussion.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Because the recording that I'm holding right now It's under Herbie Hancock's
name. Ain't that a guess?
As Baraka.
Yes, that's crazy.
Well, it's probably likely not legitimate.
Well, not only not legitimate, there's already a lawsuit, so.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my music.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Take my wine and put it in a different bottle and say it's your wine, okay?
There are five cuts on here. And
which ones?
Four of the five are written by you. Mm-hmm. But the titles that they have are Baraka. Mm-hmm.
That was for Imamu Baraka.
Malauna.
Right, for Malauna Karanga.
Kawaida.
For the religious doctrine.
And
Kamili. Yes, my wife, Kamili.
And the one that your uncle had written, Dunia.
Dunia.
Dunia. Mm-hmm.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you know what that means?
No, but I know that was his wife.
Okay.
At the time.
Okay.
Yeah. I want to stay on record.
Okay. And on this particular version, it has a bonus disc of the Heath Brothers with Pat Metheny.
Obviously, a much later cut.
Exactly. It was like sometime in 1983 or something. But originally, the recording that you did with your uncle was recorded in 1969?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. No, I just wanted to cover that while we were...
I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, so much of that Scotch taping goes around. Mm. And if you're not on top of it, you'd be surprised. I mean, you did something here and it appears in another country under another name.
Right.
And that's why it's so important that brothers and sisters really understand that they have to stay on top of their business. So all those songs are mine because I published all those.
Yes, I'm holding your father's book.
Yes.
I Walk with Giants, the autobiography of Jimmy Heath. And I have to let you know that a good chunk of the information that I wasn't aware of and that I received clarity came from this book and your contribution to it. As a matter of fact, I like the way they laid this out.
I thought it was brilliant the way they did it. Yeah. You know, it's never boring.
Right.
As opposed to chapter 1. It's just... Mm-hmm. You have this flow of consciousness, thematic fiber of interviews, you know.
And everyone speaks, and it's not just Jimmy Heath talking about Jimmy Heath. It's
right.
Other people in Jimmy Heath's life in different periods of Jimmy Heath's life. So it's a good book. So if you haven't picked it up, I'm just saying, everybody, I Walked with Giants, the autobiography of Jimmy Heath by Jimmy Heath and Joseph McLaren.
Right.
To reference from this book, when Tayari.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, when Tayari used the title The Gap Sealer for one of the albums, it showed he was unlike a lot of the cats who were closed. In the early 70s, I had been with Miles, and there were certain things I felt that musicians and composers of Tayari's stature could start to embrace that were contemporary popular music. During this time, I took a position about the music scene, especially while I was with Miles. That was an intense period for the whole music industry. There's a great book by a guy named Henry Pleasance called The Agony of Modern Music. He was a European classical music critic, but what he said also applied to jazz. He said that the European classical music arena had suffered from three things: aesthetic decay, social obsolescence, but more importantly, technical exhaustion. Meaning there was nothing else to be played on those instruments that hadn't already been played over the last couple of hundred years, unless you were one of the masters like Tayari or Sonny Rollins. That's different. The rest of us coming after them weren't going to play anything beyond that. We needed to make new music to access new sounds. And it was a hell of a schism that happened. Acoustic music versus electronic.
Right. You want me to elaborate on that schism?
Please.
Whoa. Here's what happened. And what I was referencing in that book, the book by Henry Pleasance that I spoke about in my father's book, was the fact that at a certain point, this thing, technical exhaustion, and what do I mean by that? And what did he mean? As I said, there's a certain point. It's like your growth. You grow to a certain point. Unless you go out and get some extra surgery, that's where you max. But for some reason, the jazz giants out of that era, when Miles went into the electronic arena, now, first of all, what we'd come to grips with was, if you're going to create new music, you must have access to new colors. That's all music is sound and color. But because Miles chose the direction he did, which was more what I call what we were doing, improvisational funk, you didn't have to go that way. And as I quote all the time, man, first of all, Sun Ra was doing that way before Miles. But he was doing it in more avant-garde. But I felt that the white jazz critics, and I'll just say what it was, the Leonard Feathers and all them guys and the Hentoffs, who kept saying to the black musicians, Look, man, what would McCoy Tyner have done with a synthesizer? See, that's what I'm saying. But these great musicians who had closed themselves off to the possibility of having access to new sounds. So what the critics did, like a Stanley Crouch and these guys, what they decided to do was dismiss what Miles was doing by calling it chaos. It ain't nothing. It's just noise. He's selling out. I don't know what that means. But, you know, anything other than we're creating a new aesthetic. And the point I made to all of them, first of all, you can't measure an orange by how an apple tastes. Okay, we're no longer playing jazz, so why are you talking about what it is? And you don't even have the language. You don't have a facility to analyze. And as I tell them all the time, they were all like Kool-Aid drinkers being invited to a wine tasting contest. You didn't even have palate. So why are y'all commenting? And then you saw the thing with Ken Burns did the thing on jazz.
Right.
And he's got Wynton and Stanley commenting. How come you didn't talk to none of us?
Right.
So the point I'm making, there was really a racial component to this also with Miles. The other thing, if you notice, when that band came out, we went to Japan, and I'll never forget, he had the speakers redesigned, and all the speakers had red, black, and green covers. Mm.
Wow.
Now, okay. See, every black person knows what that meant.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So what is Miles telling y'all? This is unabashedly black, and I'm going here. Now, that black doesn't mean everybody can't enjoy it, but make no mistake. I'm coming from, at that point, he was listening to a lot of James, a lot of Sly. Mm. Sly in him was hanging out.
James Brown, Sly Stone.
Yeah. But Sly was coming into the house. And they were going, he was in a period of evolution. And it wasn't no BS about he's selling out. See, that was the easy route for jazz critics because they were too lazy to develop the aesthetic or to really ask, what are we doing? And I'm going to tell you, the racial component was really deep. They never talked to any of us in the rhythm section. The only people they talked to was Dave Liebman. Because that was a vestige of the jazz and when Keith Jarrett was there.
Right.
And Keith Jarrett lied through his mouth. That's why I'm so happy for. Yeah, we telling truth.
Now, what do you mean by lying?
I'm going to tell you.
Okay.
Every interview Keith did when he left the band, talk about how horrible it was.
Yeah.
There are interviews where he's saying the guys didn't even know how to play and I was there to help Miles. I didn't even really like electronic music. Okay. Thank God for YouTube. Because you know what? When that came out in 71 when he was with the band, look at him smiling, mm-hmm. loving it.
Mm-hmm.
But he lied.
Yeah.
Dave Liebman, I respected because Dave always felt a little uncomfortable, but he played his butt off.
He did.
But he never went out and lied. Keith Jarrett lied. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I will stand in front of his face and tell him that. Look at all the quotes. All you got to do is look at the interviews and then look at when YouTube came along, people saw how much he enjoyed it. But there was this thing that Miles had all these new black guys. Well, first of all, I wasn't new. I had already played with Sonny, Herbie,
Freddie.
Gatto, Barbera, Freddie,
mm-hmm.
you know,
Freddie
Woody Shaw. I mean, come on. I was already on over 40 jazz albums. Mm-hmm. And Al Foster. You know, Al Foster
right.
played with everybody. But what Miles did, the brilliance of what he did, he said to get the most out of this improvisational funk thing, he wanted to bring jazz musicians and mold us into that canvas because he always felt the jazz musicians could bring more to the party mm-hmm. because we're just more open. And I believe that.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. And very quickly, I need to let you know that you are presently listening to a discussion that Hank Williams, Kazembe Balogun, and myself, Joyce Jones, had with James M. Toomey, who is the percussionist with Miles Davis during an electric period. Right now we're listening to the song M. Toomey, written by Miles Davis. This is from Get Up With It. And we have Miles Davis on trumpet and organ, Pete Cossey, rest in peace, on guitar. Reggie Lucas on rhythm guitar, Michael Henderson on electric bass, Al Foster on drums, James M. Tume on percussion, and Sonny Fortune on flute. Before that, we heard, we had a discussion about this. The recording I have has Herbie Hancock. Baraka is the name of this bootleg, and the song that we heard was Kawaida. And before that, we heard from Lakeisha Benjamin. Lakeisha Benjamin, LakeishaBenjamin.com, LakeishaBenjamin.com, from her release Retox on the Motema record label. We heard two selections, Jump and Shout, and before that we heard Maceo. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl and discussion with James M. Toomey. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. I'm
So that band was a brilliant amalgamation. You take the guitar player. Can I talk about that band for a minute?
Oh,
the
please members? Do.
Because that's never discussed. When it gets to that period, you talk about the period with Herbie. That, oh, yeah, Tony and Wayne or, you know, Jack D. Jeanette and so on. So you get to that period, all of a sudden, there's no names in that band. You had Reggie Lucas, phenomenal guitarist, who played rhythm in that, but he could also solo. When he joined the band, Miles had gotten Reggie. We became writing partners later, you know, in R&B and pop. But
in the group
Reggie was playing with Arnett Coleman, studying the harmonic theory. The other guitarist, phenomenal guitarist, Pete Cozy. Pete Cozy was playing with the ACM. He played with all the avant-garde. Also, he played with B.B. King, Muddy Waters. I saw and suggested Pete Cozy for the band. When Michael Henderson took me to hear him, we were in Detroit. He was playing with Gene Allen. Pete Cozy has six different tuning systems. You hear me? So when we play Berkeley, when all the college guys and guitar, they're sitting there, it's like if you took a piano and reversed the keys. He reversed all the strings six different ways. And when he starts playing, what's coming out ain't got nothing to do with what you're looking at. You know what I mean? So then you had Al Foster, brilliant drummer, played with everybody, Sonny Rollins, U Masekela. So, and the guy who held it all together, who never gets credit, was Michael Henderson. Michael Henderson, the bassist. Miles got Michael because he, in order to go anywhere, the bass has got to be the bottom. Not the bottom, like in terms of where it ranks, but that's what's holding all that together.
Right.
And Michael came out, he was a prodigy out of Motown. Michael was 14 years old when he was recording for Motown with the Dramatics and all that. He was out with Stevie Wonder. So on this thing, he brought this amalgamation of cats that would not normally have gone in that direction. But with his leadership, we molded something. At the time, they all wanted to dismiss it as crazy, and he'd lost his mind, you know, because he refused to look back. And that was one of the main things I learned from Miles. Never look back. The brilliance for him, for me, was that once he crossed the bridge, he burnt it. So I can't even get back. So it was always straight ahead and forward. And like I said, it's time that people start telling the truth. And all these jive critics who had no relationship to us. You know what? If I don't know what you're doing, sister, wouldn't the intelligent thing be for me to call you? You know what? I'd like to sit there. Can you explain to me what you're playing?
Right.
They didn't ask.
Right.
And there was also this element that we were rebels. Mm-hmm. Well, they were correct about that, you know, and we didn't care.
Right.
And so they caught this vibe from these young cats that, and we really didn't care. If you look at the cover, the real change started with the album On the Corner. Thank you. If you get an original copy of On the Corner, first of all, look at these caricatures. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the Free Me, the guy looks like the Panther Party, there's the
right.
Pimp. There's
mm-hmm.
On the Corner was about black street life. And he had a rock band on there. And if you look at the bass drum that the rock drummer was playing, it says Foot Foolers, meaning that this ain't the beat. And so what Miles did, because he was so sick of the critics trying to analyze, he didn't put nobody's name on the album. And he said, now y'all figure out who's playing. And the critics went bonkers. This is a But they didn't know. The thing was, we would play a sold-out concert, brother, and the people were hearing some music that had never been created. They would walk out mesmerized. Mm-hmm. The next day, you read the review, this is the worst chaotic music. I mean, he doesn't even know what he's doing now. He's lost his mind. He's got a wah-wah on his trumpet. Yeah. How about that?
Not to break in, but what was the process like for the audience? Because there's this incredible piece in the documentary Miles Electric where you're talking about that. And you say at one point a bottle or something like that flies past your head.
Oh.
And one of the things you learned from Miles was he just came up to you and he said, play through it.
That was an amazing, right, you know my background. I'm coming out of black nationalist struggle, right. You know.
The US
organization. In Europe. I think we were in Venice. The concert was like maybe almost an hour and a half, almost 2 hours late because it wasn't Miles' fault. There was a hang-up with getting the equipment on those boats because you had to get the equipment by boat to the concert hall. So, you know, the crowd was getting a little anxious. So this is also the first time they're going to hear. Some of these people was expecting kind of blue, you know, but, you know,
right.
the footprints. So we come out, wow, and man, the place goes off, and you hear this hollering, and I'm playing, and a roll of toilet paper goes by my face. Now, you know, and I'm like, okay, no. So I'm getting ready to go where any brother would go, you know what
right.
I mean? And he saw me and walked over to me, and I'll never forget his words. He said, play through it. He said, ain't but two vibes. The vibe out there and the vibe up here. Play through it. At the end of that night, it was a 15-minute standing ovation, and I learned a hell of a lesson. Play through it. Stick to what you're doing.
Well, why don't we take a step back for a second, because we're getting into your time with Miles, and that's what we want to spend a lot of time on. But when did you actually get the call from Miles, and did you expect it, and what was that whole process like? Because it seems like everybody has their own story about when they actually got the call.
You know, and everybody's story is always the same. Like, it ain't really him. You know what I mean?
right.
I remember I was laying on the floor listening to Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, and the phone rang, and is this him to me? I said, yes. He said, this is Miles. He said, you ready to go on tour with me? I started laughing and hung up. No, this is the truth. Because me and my friend Ndugu, who was the drummer with Miles at that time. See, we came up together in L.A. playing.
Ndugu Chancellor.
Yes, Ndugu Chancellor. That's my man. And that was the joke. And then the phone rang again. I picked up. And I can't say what he said. You know, like, you know, this is me. You know, I said, ooh. So he said, I want you in my band. And I'm going to be in Europe for a few months. And that's how I got it. Now, how I found out how he got hip to me, he came to hear me play. Well, at that time when I came to New York, Mickey Rocha told me something when I was in L.A. You know, that was when I was kind of getting my chops together.
Another drummer, Mickey Rocha.
Yes, Mickey Rocha. Fabulous, famous drummer from Philly. So Mickey came, you know, all these guys, you know, I grew up, man, you know, since I was a little kid. So Mickey told me once, he was out there with, I think, Freddie or somebody. And he told me, he said, man, I've been hearing about you, you know, back, you know, the word's getting back that you really, you know, you playing really well. So, you know, I was like, yeah, you know, I'm trying to. He said, well, you'll never know if you're good enough till you come back to the East Coast. He said, that's where the trial is. And I'm looking like, well, hey, man. And I thought about it. As one thing led to another, I ended up being on the East Coast. You know, the organization had disbanded for the most part, us. So I go back to the East Coast to work with Imamu Baraka on the first Ken Gibson campaign, which was going to be the first black mayor on the East Coast. So I had my instruments with me. Now, the funny thing is, I made a list of three people I wanted to play with, like your dream team.
Right.
First on that list was Freddie Hubbard. Second on that list was McCoy Tyner. Third was Miles. Now, feel me. This is true. 2 weeks after I get to Newark, I get a phone call from a friend of mine named Brother M. Fawasi, who was very close with McCoy. He calls me up and says, yo, McCoy wants you on a record date next week. Here's his number. I get that call. I end up doing six albums with McCoy. But also during that period, I get a call from Freddie Hubbard. Now, it was when I was playing with Freddie Hubbard that Miles came to see me. I didn't know that. I only knew it after we finished the set because he's, you know how we at the Village Vanguard. And you know how that, you got those booths on the side. Evidently, he was sitting right there next to me. But you know, I'm into the music.
Right.
And he got up and split. And everybody said, man, Miles was here, Miles. I was like, oh, wow. So that was the third. So the three people I ended up playing with. But obviously with him, that became, you know, the next 4 or 5 years. Standing next to him every night.
On Friday, June 22nd, join family and friends of political prisoner Sekou Odinga in a happy birthday fundraiser for Sekou's freedom campaign. Your donations include food, spoken word, song, fun, films, and dancing. Help us honor and defend one of our captured freedom fighters. That's Friday, June 22nd, 6 p.m. to 11 at Harlem's Maisel's Cinema, 345 Malcolm X Boulevard at 127th Street. For more information, email SekouOdingaDefenseCommittee@gmail.com. That's SekouOdinga DefenseCommittee@gmail.com. Or call 718-512-5008.
WBAI will have a live broadcast of the Report to the Listener on Wednesday, June 27th from 3 to 5 p.m. Department heads will collectively give the reports and engage in a brief dialogue for the first 30 to 40 minutes, then take listener phone calls for the remainder of the 2 hours. Once again, WBAI will be broadcasting a live report to the listener on Wednesday, June 27th from 3 to 5 p.m.
The Hip Hop Takeover is happening again. For 24 hours, WBAI will broadcast this exciting radio event starting Friday at midnight, June 29th to Saturday midnight, June 30th. Prepare to be entertained all while being educated. For more information and the latest on host, guest, and the schedule, check us out on Facebook at The Hip Hop Takeover. The Hip Hop Takeover, only on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Yo, check this out. This is Chuck, your public enemy number one, the rebel without a pause, bringing the noise and fighting the power right here to the Sights and Sounds. That's right, Sights, 99.5 WBAI.
listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar My Bowl is the name of this program. We're listening to a very long prelude, part one. Prelude, part one, from Agartha, Miles Davis, on the Columbia label. This is 1976. And let's see who we got on here. James M. Toomey, of course, on congas. Oh, yep, there he is now. Along with Miles Davis on trumpet. And we have Reggie Lucas on guitar, Al Foster on drums, Pete Cozy on guitar and percussion, various percussion, I guess. And Michael Henderson on Fender bass. And before that, we heard from On the Corner. From On the Corner, we heard Mr. Freedom X. And that, too, is on the Columbia label. And let's see. Whew. There it is. Okay, very quickly, we have on Mr. Freedom X, we have Miles Davis on trumpet, Bud Elroy on tabla, Colin Walcott on sitar, where applicable, Michael Henderson on bass, James M. Toomey on percussion, Herbie Hancock on keyboard, Harold I. Williams Jr. on keyboard, David Creamer on guitar, William W. Hart on drums, Jack DeJohnette on drums, and Carlos Garnett on tenor sax. Stay tuned for more Sugar in My Bowl. Coming up next with James M. Toomey. My name's Joyce Jones. You'll be hearing from Hank Williams and Kazembe Balogun as well. Stay tuned. In the Heath book, you refer to your time with Miles as being in MD University.
Yes, yes.
What was the learning process like? How did Miles develop artists?
He developed artists by showing you what you didn't know, but you did know. And what do I mean by that? Learning how to play what you don't know. That was his favorite phrase. He said, play what you don't know. And when you first hear that, oh, what? Run like you don't run. Well, wait a minute, what do you mean? You know, but what you understand is explore, because you have it in you. The other part of his genius, he knew everyone and what everybody could bring to the canvas and every band he's ever put together. And every cat will tell you that he gave you the freedom to explore. I was able to take the instrument as far out as I could. Nothing was off limits. And what you learned was that exploration is the most important part of being an artist. Also, you learn how to listen. Because the confusion that the jazz critics had, they didn't understand. See, now, if Coltrane, they can sit up and listen to Ohm, and everybody's, and they'll tell you, oh, yeah, you feel what so-and-so's doing? But because we were electronic, all of a sudden, that was chaos. No, it wasn't. We were all playing off of each other. And as a matter of fact, on that debate that's on YouTube with me and Stanley Crouch, I actually bring, at the end of the debate, like a minute or a minute and a half example, and I showed the audience. We changed time signatures three times. We went 4-4, 5-4, back to 4-4. And unless I pointed out, you would have never dug it. Because we were doing what we called seamless transition.
Turn it up! Right back to 5-4 without saying a word.
Tune machine, man. We really knew what we were doing, and we studied it. It was no joke. It was serious, very serious music.
Let's go a little bit deeper into the electric scene. Did you actually have problems in terms of hearing yourself, you know, in the middle of everything that was going on? And was there anything special you actually had to do to prepare to play, you know, in that type of situation?
Yeah, we were full blown. So right. You playing behind two guitars with Marshall amps. You got Michael, you got Al, boom, 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 drums and mic. So one day, I'm thinking, okay, I got to, you know, these are hand drums. I mean, I play keyboard, so I knew all these textures I wanted to try. So I said, man, what if I just mic my drums? Actually have mics on them.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did I do that, I eventually developed my own foot pedal stuff where I could do, I didn't have a wah-wah hooked up, but all these digital things where
right.
I can make sounds swimming. So take the hand instrument and take it where it's never been heard before. So, but definitely I had to mic up. So each one of my drums had a mic built on it. So that's the only way you could cut through that, you know. But again, the exploration of sound and texture, that's all it's ever really been about. That's one of the unfortunate aspects of a lot of the younger musicians. It's a quote I use all the time, and I say, genius is predicated upon one's contribution to their generation that was different mm-hmm. from anybody else. And predicated on that reality, you can't have genius if these cats are playing the same stuff that the cats played in the 60s. Now, you can be great with it, but you're not expanding the boundaries.
Right.
So if I'm playing the same stuff that our Blakey played, just because I'm 22, I just got out of school. And unfortunately, school doesn't prepare you for exploration. It prepares you to pretty much regurgitate. And in a sense, now, we're going to take a step here. In a very interesting sense, it's also a generational form of sampling. Now, what do I mean by that? Rappers will sample a record. A lot of the young jazz artists sample the playing styles, but it's still sampling. Mm-hmm. How is somebody great? Oh, man, he's great. He sounds just like Train. What?
But they sample riffs as well.
That's what I'm saying. Right. Or somebody's great because they sound like Miles. I mean, that's what you don't want to be. The one thing about the great jazz artist and any artist, you want to find your own signature. And you only find your own signature through a three-step process, what I call imitation, emulation, and then innovation. I don't care who you are, there's somebody that turned you on as an artist, as a painter, as a musician, as a poet, and you said, I want to do it just like that. That's your imitation stage, and you kind of get into that, and you're pretty much coming after that person. A little later on, we get to what I call the emulation, and you still got a lot of that other person's influence, but you're starting to find a little of yourself. And if you're lucky enough and fortunate, you evolve to innovation. That's when you put all that stuff in your funnel and you come out with that, who you are.
Well, in the Electric Miles film, that was probably one of the first films that I actually noticed your hands playing. And I play percussion. So I was a little confused. I was like, seriously? Is he really playing? I was like, well, what kind of playing style is that?
Yeah, yeah.
But then, you know, in reading, once again, your father's book, I found out about and having seen Soul Power with Big Black.
Mm-hmm.
And his solo.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed how his hands looked very similar to yours.
That was my, we all have a mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And Big Black, when I saw him, somebody gives you the direction.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw him, and I actually played with him in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
at the Watts Summer Festival in 1968.
Okay.
And I said, this, because this is it. One of my problems with Kungas, everybody pretty much came out of the Afro-Cuban
yes.
or the African, mm-hmm. straight-up African
yes.
approach. I wasn't interested in that. That was done, and I respect it. But see, I was practicing to Elvin Jones and Tony Williams. I'm playing to those records.
Right.
And because I'm a keyboard player, I also tune my instruments in fourths. So I'm playing these rhythms, but you also hear melody coming out.
Right, right.
So, again, my biggest influence in terms of technical approach is Elvin Jones. Mm-hmm. And you learn how to play and learning how to play in different time signatures.
Right.
So I'll play in 5/4, 7/4, all that other stuff that, you know.
Right.
You got to kind of know, you know what I mean?
Right.
And so that also made me more available to explore what Miles was doing, and he also knew that.
Back to Al Foster a moment, and can you just talk a little bit about, you know, what it was like playing with him, and I think maybe a little bit more specifically, because there are periods in the recording where it seems like there's an incredible connection between you two, and you're really playing off each other.
Al, I first saw Al in L.A. when he was at U-Master Caleb. Master Caleb had just come, and it was his first album, The Americanization of Ooga Booga. Yeah, I remember, but at that time, the whole Black Power movement was developed. Again, I think this was like 67, somewhere in there, maybe 69. So here's Al Foster, and I'm watching, and I'm hearing this cat swing. He just captured me, and the next time I met him was on the session. Al came, he played on, I think, On the Corner. So you got me going back, and I got Alzheimer's. I got to remember. Yes, On the Corner, because before that, the European tour, the first tour I joined with Miles, that was in Dubu. And then when we came back off that tour, Miles hired Jack DeJohnette. So then we went laid off because Miles was in search of what he's going to do next. And matter of fact, he called me one day because we would hang out a lot. We would talk in the book, in his autobiography, I mean, literally 4 or 5 times a week and always late at night because we were both insomniac.
Right.
Okay. So one day he calls me and said, man, come on over. I want to go somewhere. So I go over to the house and we go up to this Chinese restaurant he used to like to go to. It's closed now, but it was on 125th Street. It wasn't but about 5 tables in there. But, you know, that was his spot. So we're sitting there for about an hour and a half talking. So when we get up to walk out, he looks at me and he said, So what did you think? Wait, what did I think? He said, the music. And I said, oh, this is like a book. You listen to the Indian music. He said, I'm getting ready to fuse Indian tablas and sitar with the funk. Ergo on the corner.
Wow.
Now you heard that. Ain't nobody told you that story. That's real. He said, that's where we're going. We're going to start this new album. And this is what I'm bringing. Tablas, sitars, you know. Al, remember, it's a jazz drummer.
Mm-hmm.
See? And so, give me a jazz drummer that I can convert to funk like Miles did, and you get another kind of feel. You know, Al is a much greater drummer than people understood. I mean, Miles had him in a role, okay? Because he had to keep that thing.
Right.
And I know a lot of times, I was the one freed up to go, you know, I could go on the safari, you know,
yeah,
playing all
exactly.
through it. That was my role. But I know sometimes, I've never gotten a chance to tell Al, man, how great I felt he was and know he is. And I know sometimes it felt a little stiff, but everybody had a role. But Al Foster, man, he's amazing. An amazing drummer. Amazing. And a really good cat. He raised all of his children. And that's a hell of a man.
Well, you just stumbled upon our videographer's question.
No, I was going to ask the influence of Buddy Roy and classical Indian music on Miles' playing in the later period.
Badal was a really, really wonderful musician and a really nice cat. We hooked up immediately because he was looking at me like, the way you play, because he had never seen anybody approach congas like that. And I told him, well, I listened to a lot of Ravi Shankar. And he was like, yeah, I said, yeah, the tablas, because some of what I do comes out of that. So I had never officially studied tabla, but here's a tabla player, and he's with this cat who's doing congas another kind of way. So we were able to fuse something. I mean, we'd just be grinning at each other, because it was like that, you know. And for the period he was in the band, we had a ball. Matter of fact, Badal Roy became very famous in India. I remember when he came, we were somewhere, and he bought a newspaper that somebody had sent him from New Delhi. And they showed him, man, with a picture with us. And it said, you know, Badal Roy, I mean, he was a national hero. He's with Miles, you know. And I was very happy for him. But he's a great musician and really a nice man.
Did Miles Davis want to go further in that direction?
No, we went as far as he wanted to go because he was taking the sound to his highest common denominator.
Okay.
I don't say lowest, the highest common denominator, where we all kind of was playing like those instruments were still there, mm-hmm. you know, but we were able to compensate. So the sitar player was no longer there. Pete Cozy took over a larger role with coloration. Mm-hmm. Reggie locked the rhythm. Mm-hmm. And I was able to handle between me and Al that what I call that choo-choo train.
Right.
I mean, you know, when that stuff locks, there's moments where I can't even explain it. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. There was one time we were playing in Denver in a club. It was in a hotel. So we were staying in the hotel. Club's on the bottom floor. We played a set for about 2.5 hours. It was one set. We all got in the elevator. Nobody said a word. Okay, it was transforming. Mm-hmm. Miles came in and laid on the floor of the elevator. And he said, oh, and that was it. Nobody ever said it. We all got off the elevator. It was like Zunar.
Wow.
I mean, I've had those moments a couple times. I felt the stage elevate. Mm-hmm. I mean, for real, I ain't crazy. You know, but I mean, I know it's not moving, but
when
you're in that thing and everybody's in tune like that,
mm-hmm.
and you're also exploring new territory.
Right.
See, that's the other thing, the excitement. Like, look, I ain't going to sit up here and lie. Some nights we start a journey and like, oh, this is the wrong street. Okay? But you went there.
Right,
you
had to,
so now you know, don't go down that street. Try this other boulevard. Right. But it's the exploration. But when it clicked, it's nothing like it. Nothing like it.
Now, see, that is the sort of thing. I mean, you've said it during the course of this exchange that, and it was said before that it wasn't jazz. But that is my understanding of what, quote, jazz actually is, that exploration.
Right.
That pushing the boundaries, that, you know.
Sure.
Okay.
No, you're absolutely right. See, you have to make a distinction between appearance and appearance. Mm. Okay? It may appear to be that, but apparently it's not, because you're listening to what the sound is coming off that stage.
Mm-hmm.
Miles basically never changed his style.
Right.
Mm-hmm. See, that's the thing, that if you listen to all those periods, when he was with Bird for the Cool, you know, the Herbies, Wayne Shorter, Tony Williams, Ron Carter period, all those periods, his approach was still Miles.
Exactly.
It became more radical in that band because it was almost like, okay, this is what it is. Now this is uncut funk.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what it is. And so when he added the wah-wah, now think of this. This cat is playing a wah-wah on a trumpet.
Mm-hmm.
To this day, I ain't heard it I've seen a couple of cats try it, but not. I mean, man, we would play 2.5-3 hours, mm-hmm. and I'm watching this cat, and we young bucks, mm-hmm. and he's hitting it. And you better be hitting it.
Right.
Okay? So there was an amazing energy that always happened. You were prepared to go on a journey every night. And some people say that, but Miles had the baddest safari you could be on in every period of his music. And ask the cats in that band at that period, and they'll all say, because they were all doing something that hadn't been done. That's the thing.
And a lot of the musicians also took that time during that period, that, quote, electric period, and found their way to expand on the music in that way. You, on the other hand, and I wasn't going to go.
I thought
here.
We weren't going to go there. Okay. go ahead.
Well, you didn't go in that direction.
No.
And you went to something more, I guess, conventional and.
Yeah, you call it conventional. It was also, see, you can't do anything that ain't who you are. Mm-hmm. And do it for real, you know. It's just like, you know, worst thing in the world. I always tell people, as a jazz drummer that can't funk and then plays a funky beat, it's corny. Mm-hmm. You know, you just sound like wet toilet paper, you know what I mean? But you get a cat that's playing any music, when you see that musician is playing, and he's playing the essence of what that's supposed to be, it goes through your body.
Right.
I had this weird upbringing as a kid in the 50s. As a matter of fact, I remember one day when the music appreciation class, well, they still had that back then. I don't know if it happens now. The teacher told us, I think it was in fifth grade, everybody bring two records. I brought Frankie Lyman and Miles Davis, Kinda Blue. All the other kids brought on the rock and roll thing, you know, the R&B stuff, mm-hmm. and everybody was hitting it. And then when the teacher put on Kinda Blue, it was like everybody went, kids were like, ah. And that's when I realized, wow, I'm growing up with both sides. Mm-hmm. So I've always admired this before Miles. I was always fascinated with Motown. My first inspiration was Curtis Mayfield. And I always wanted to know one day what it would feel like to write those songs, never thinking I'd be a songwriter. So when I started doing this, I was feeling an aspect of myself that was different from that other music. Because you could listen to Miles, and then you listen to The Closer I Get to You, then you can go back to Kawaita or Al Cable Line. You say, what? You know, and then I'll score TV, you know what I mean? So New York Undercover. I mean, my whole thing was I wanted touching all the aspects of me. I'm not one-dimensional, you know. I'm not a one-dimensional musician.
So that was sort of a continuation from the studies from MD University.
MD. People say, where'd you go to school? MD University. Right. Do you know any place better? But the songwriting was just awesome. Well, look, just like the politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, people hear me on the open line now. You know, I've been doing that with Brother Slade and Brother Pickett.
Oh, and congratulations on
We're now on BLS.
Yes.
But the point is, that was always, like you just said, brother, you took me back. Well, I was in Us. I've always been politically involved. But they hear that part now. But I was the same guy when I was playing with Miles, same guy when he was doing all this other stuff.
Right.
It's just the different times in your life you get a chance to explore or let people see another side, that it's way more than what they think.
Well, during that time, one would have thought that your taking an R&B route would have been a sellout. Mm-hmm. And in the subject of Miles, it was considered, the electric period was considered a sellout.
Sure. That word sellout, it always brings me a wonderful smile. Because let me tell you something. If Miles wanted to really sell out, all he ever had to do was turn around and go play that old music, which he said he would never do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I forget where we were, but he would always call me in the dressing room and we would talk. And there were these Japanese businessmen there. And they were offering a ton of money. I mean, huge money, a lot of yen, to just come do two concerts playing the Kinda Blue album. That's all. Just two, like $3 million back then. And I saw him say, I can't do that.
Hmm.
And I'm like, well, look, man, for $3 million, man, wait a minute. You know,
can there be a little negotiation?
Yeah, I'll go get a tambourine and tell you, come on now. No, but that was part of the respect. And after they left, he told me, he said, and this is deep. He said, Mtume, if I ever played any of that old music again, it would kill me.
Mm.
Now, fast forward, Montreux.
Right.
Quincy Jones gets Miles to play Sketches in Spain now. Mm. Miles died a few months after that.
Wow.
And when I saw that, when I was watching it, I teared up and I was crying. Tears were coming to my eyes because I knew he was ill. I didn't know what was happening because at one point he passed the trumpet to
Wallace Roney.
Wallace, excuse me. Wallace, if you're listening, brother, forgive me. He hands his trumpet to Wallace to finish the solo. And I knew something, and my mind went back. The reason why I teared up, I just thought about what he told me.
Right.
And I'm looking, and he died a few months later. But so all these people, sellout, let's get back to that. And half of the people calling you sellout, the same one asking you for $5. But the bottom line is, what is selling out? If you're doing something because you don't really feel it, but you're just trying to get on, then that's selling out. Mm-hmm. If you're playing it from here, you ain't selling out. How are you selling out? I say one thing. I give all those people that say that, I give them one challenge. Y'all put a band together and play anything close to what we were doing. Then I'll show you what it is. Okay? A lot of these cats run around talking about they played funk because they played in a house band playing P-funk charts. No, no, you ain't right them. It's about the essence of what you do. See? So selling out, that's a lot of that is just an easy way to dismiss. I mean, we can use words, oh, he's so-and-so, he's so-and-so. Well, yeah, but what does that mean? Get past the category. Now explain it. Where did he sell out? And that was the argument they would bring, Stanley Crouch and all of his clothes and all. Wait, what are you talking about? So he didn't want to dress the same way. He didn't want to play the same way. He had a different woman. What are you talking about? You wearing the same stuff you was wearing 40 years ago. He changed. And every time he changed his music, he changed his whole mantra. That sellout, a lot of that is jealousy, and there's a lot of people who don't want to grow. Now, if you choose to just play acoustically, fine. I respect that. But don't down this other thing. Talking about if you plug in, you out. And I ask this. Why is it that in every other aspect of life, technology is important? We're talking through the microphone. Okay?
Right.
So, but why is it when it gets to music, somebody gets a computer or somebody plugs into a synthesizer? Ooh. I had a great conversation with a man that I love dearly, and to me is still one of the greatest musicians I've ever seen in my life. I never had the opportunity to play with him, but we was always cool. Rahsaan Roland Kirk. Mm. And I remember it was Howard University, Crampton Auditorium, Miles Davis and Rahsaan.
Wow.
So Miles always played first. Wherever we were, he just liked to hit it. He said, leave that stage hot. So we got off the stage. So Rahsaan, who was always, I'm going to tell you how Rahsaan is, what a wonderful cat he is, but he's a real jokester. That first tour with Miles, we're in Europe, and the phone rings. It's like 3 in the morning in the room. I'm in the hotel. And so I picked the phone up. I said, yeah, hello? He said, hey, man, all right, I respect you. I said, who's this? He said, man, this is Rahsaan. He said, I thought, you know, a lot of guys use them African names, but it just, when they register, I look at me, you know, Billy Johnson. He said, no, you really James him too, man. You registered with that name. I said, yeah, brother. He said, I respect that. That's how Rahsaan is. So anyway, so we coming off stage, and me and Rahsaan was cool. So we coming off, and Rahsaan told me, yeah, ain't no amplifiers in Africa. You know, but I mean, Rahsaan would do it to me. And I looked at him because he knew I was quick. I said, yeah, Rahsaan, ain't no saxophones either. So he fell out. That was the kind of cat Rahsaan was, man. But, you know, here's a guy who played 3 horns at one time with different melodies.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, the stuff these people were doing, man, you can't even get close. Mm-hmm. And I just don't want young brothers to pursue being replicas of what has already been. You don't have to be the curator for the National Museum of Jazz. Mm. Find your own signature.
Well, you'd started talking about the idea of scoring, and you briefly touched on your work with New York Undercover.
Yes.
But is there anything that you wanted to add to that, or maybe particularly for younger musicians out there who are coming up and need to learn the business aspect of it?
Well, that's an excellent question, brother. I was very fortunate. Before New York Undercover, I had scored a film called Native Son. It was predicated on the Richard Wright novel.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, it was Oprah Winfrey's first acting gig, you know. But years later, I got a call from Andre Harrell, and he said this new show that they were developing with Dick Wolf. And he said, man, I'd like you to consider coming in and scoring. So I said, there was a short list of people they were looking at. I said, well, fine. And when I saw it was a dramatic series, first of all, there was no dramatic series representing Latinos and blacks with that urban thing, that urban feel. And I looked at it and I said, well, here's an opportunity. And for me personally, of everything I've been so fortunate to be involved in, New York Undercover was the most important because I felt there was an opportunity for me to put a black sound on television, our sound, in a way that it had never been heard. Not on television. You know, the chase scenes on all them shows. No, Cornelius.
Okay. Well, they were like jazz soundtracks to themes.
So we come on with... So that's the thing I'm most proud of, because I felt I could represent us in a way that it hadn't been done. Miami Vice is the only other example where you watch that. You can't talk about that show without talking about the music.
No.
New York Undercover, we took it even further with the opening montage, because you didn't know if you were watching a video, you know, where the show would open. Then we'd also do the Natalie's, where at that time, when we started 94 and 95, Arsenio Hall had just been taken off. So basically, there was nowhere to see black acts.
Right.
Not on television.
Right.
So we had this thing, Natalie's, that was originally designed for the cops to meet, you know, and talk and stuff. And
that was a club that was featured in New York.
Right. So I'm saying, well, look, why don't we use this? But here's the difference. I'll bring young acts in and have them redo a classic, and have the classic acts come in and redo their classic. But no, this ain't going to be Soul Train. You ain't doing your hit. So Mary J. would come in and do Natural Woman. Everybody was on that. You couldn't talk about New York Undercover and not talk about that music. So, again, that was for us. And I've never gotten more joy than sitting down there looking at a scene and putting our flavor on it. I'm saying all that to say that it's important that young musicians understand there are other ways to go. And it's songwriting, that's one thing, craft, but also composing. But again, you got to study. You got to study your craft. You can't sample a love scene for a movie. You got to play it. And just in terms of that, broadening your horizons. And I just think that if there's anything to be... Look, and I'm not against sampling. I don't want nobody to get confused on it. I always say sampling is fine as a tool in creativity, not a substitute for it. But I think that what has happened, we're getting to the point now where, where's the new music? I'm a little confused. I mean, for the first time, I'm hearing all the black acts sound like it's Euro. Everything is doing, everybody got the auto-tunes.
Yeah.
I'm not against that. I'm with all that. But look here, you can't all be the same. Because the whole thing in music and in any art is learning to have and find the difference in the familiar.
Where is the venue now for younger artists to really get deep and get to that third level that you were talking
innovation.
About? Right.
I don't know. You know, it'll have to come from them. See, each generation contributes what it has to do for that development, for that journey. And the younger generation will have to create that venue for themselves. All we can do, those of us who have come before, is be there to help, like the older heads were for me. Now, I'm an old head. I'm one of the older cats. I'm always open to help. But they'll have to develop that. That revolution has to start within that generation.
Well, I guess that might be the corollary to that, because is there the type of musical community now that there was then where you could come in and actually have that type of interaction and be brought along in that way? And if not, how do you go about creating that?
That's a very interesting question, because if I were to answer that just predicated on what I see, I would say, no, it isn't. The mentorship. There's been a cutoff of the generations. And I always say that becomes a break in the cultural continuity.
Right.
So if you don't have old heads showing you certain things, then how are you going to get it? So if all the professors are taken out of the classroom, then who's the students? You know, you can't teach yourself that which you don't know. And that's the thing that was a horrendous thing that happened in the music when we had this generational breakdown. And it had a lot to do with the social things, you know, the older generation, the younger generation, the tense, the old heads was against rap and all that. But that tension actually has created a division that has also not allowed us to grow. See, all old, you need to be with some young people. All young, you need to be with some old people. That's the only way you can merge this and have the whole glass of water of our culture. Right now, it is very divided. But don't give me broccoli and tell me it's greens, meaning I know the fake.
Right. Okay? Well, on the subject, the gap sealer.
Yes. Thank you.
that was the title of a recording that you had done with your father.
Right.
Which, once again, I derived from I Walked With Giants, Jimmy Heath's autobiography.
Wonderful book. If you guys that don't have it, get it.
And the Gap Sealer was created as a what? Describe the Gap Sealer.
Well, we were talking, he was talking about that. The need, there's this gap.
Right.
And that music can be part of that Gap Sealer, because, he was always open, is open. And the quote that you read earlier in the interview, that was one of the things that always made him and just a few others of the masters, that they're open to change. Most people, for whatever reason, age sometimes makes us resistant to change. The minute you become resistant to change, then you're a prisoner of the same. And you will do it the same way. And that's what made, for example, what made Miles so absolutely brilliant. He changed music, the whole direction, 3 or 4 times. As a jazz musician, I always say this. He directly influenced all jazz. But once he electrified and began to explore that, he influenced all music worldwide, programmatic. One is a direct influence, the other is a programmatic influence. Dave Matthews, Rolling Stones, I don't even name them, Most Def. They all say, bam, Miles. So that's the part that's most important. And that's one of the things I hope that they capture in the movie that they're getting ready to do, the Miles Davis film. Because far too often when people talk about Miles from the jazz thing, they lock into, the Kind of Blue and all that. No. If you miss the doors that Bitches Brew opened on the corner, then you don't understand how that exploded and influenced the whole world of music.
And there's a project that you mentioned in Jimmy Heath's book as well. A new project that you're working on, trying to get Jill Scott and other hip-hop artists.
Well, we're in the process of trying to... I'm talking about Jimmy, my father, Tayati, is one of the greatest big band jazz composers ever. What would that sound like on top of hip-hop? And bringing in guests. Yeah, like those... I would love to hear what Common would do on the big band. I'm also working with a young artist, rapper named Ohaney, who's out of Philadelphia. And we're working on rapping to bebop. He does rap to Thelonious Monk. See, there's these avenues that can be traveled. It's right there.
But to go back full circle, interestingly, Miles' last project was doo-bop.
Absolutely right. He never stopped. He burned all the bridges. He never stopped. And hopefully that's something that I learned. Creativity has no beginning or end. It's just where people decide to sit down. I'm not interested in sitting down. When I stop? When I'm laid down. Hey, this has been great. I'm really glad I came.
Really,
but this has been a real honor and a real pleasure.
Well, thank you very much, Brother M2 Mavis.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Thank you, sister.
And that was James M. Toomey visiting WBAI. He came into our studios. It apparently had been a while since he had been in here. Somebody invited him a long time ago, but in any event, he sat with us for a while, sat with me, Joyce Jones, Hank Williams, and our videographer, Kazembe Balagoon, who's happy Father's Day. It's dark, so I'm still going to say it. Happy Father's Day to Kazembe. He's a new dad, as I mentioned in the piece. He has a son named Miles. So what we're listening to right now is the Gap Sealer from Jimmy Heath. And let's see, before that we heard the theme from New York Undercover. Yes, it was there. We talked about it. We were going to talk about it, but I'm glad we did. And that was actually another one of Kazembe Balagoon's questions. It just happened to come around, as did the Badal Roy question. Before that, we heard right off the theme. That was Miles Davis from Miles Davis in Concert Live at Philharmonic Hall. Before that, we heard Tattoo, T-A-T-U, Part 2, from Dark Magus, Dark M-A-G-U-S, for those who may not know. Before that, as I had mentioned, we heard Prelude, Part 1, from Agarda. And stay tuned, coming up next is La Nueva Alternativa. They're on their way in right now, as a matter of fact. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. We'll be back next month. I guess there will be another drive when we get back. But stay tuned to this listener-supported radio station. By the way, at Sugar in My Bowl, SugaInMyBowl.org, you can see links to the video that was mentioned with Stanley Crouch and James M. Toomey, which was one of the motivators for getting this program started. I'm going to end with a lady having the last word, Abby Lincoln, from The People in Me. And James M. Toomey was playing on this, along with some other, actually one other musician from Miles Davis's band, Al Foster, on drums. Oh, and Dave Liebman, excuse me, on soprano sax and tenor sax and flute. Africa, stay tuned. Once again, this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, La Nueva Alternativa, coming up next.
I took the trip to Paris. I saw the Eiffel Tower. I flew to Honolulu. It's the South Pacific power. I traveled with Burma all across the Bay of Biscay. I went to Old Malaya. What a perfect locale. Traveled here and yonder, and I never found a home. I guess it must be written all my life to roam.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.